Hey Peter, Howard here from the Dynasty Crossroads Show. Did you know people that listen to the Dynasty Crossroads Show are 20% more likely to be happy? Probably, maybe. This and other maybe facts on the Dynasty Crossroads. Check it out.
Yeah. Chicken a crow, crossing the...
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Read and React, the fantasy football podcast that looks at the other side of football. But whenever I do that, I always feel like I should say the other side of football. So I'm going to do that. My name's Tom Kisingberry. I'll be your host today. Love being a host, and mainly I'm being a host because I'm joined here by a stunning, wild, extravagantly, magnificently talented person in the IDP world. It is the one, the only, John Macri, coming live from the frozen tundra of Canada. John, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing much better after that very uplifting intro of me. I think it builds me up in a light that maybe is a little bit overblown, but I appreciate it either way. Yes, I'm happy to come on the podcast and talk. This is my first time on Read and React, so I'm very excited. I'm happy to talk football with you. We've done it a few times on the other show, but this will be fun.
I mean, we were just talking football before and we sort of forgot to hit record. So just to recap what we're saying, the reason I'm really happy to have you on, John, and we rarely have guests because I'm really bad at organising anything, is because I think we both come at this from the same place. So what I want to do in the IDP world is increase our sum total of knowledge. Some stuff we know, some stuff we assume, some of that is right, some of it's wrong. I think in the last 5 years in particular, we've come on leaps and bounds in understanding what's important, what is predictive, what actually describes truth, how you can see that going forward, what we should reward, how leads should be put together, all that stuff. And I think you are doing a brilliant job of asking all those same questions. So I love talking football with you.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly it, right? It's understanding, you know, what's going on with defenses and everything that goes into like our IDPs and things like that. And you know, trying to help people win fantasy football leagues is the main thing, right? So if we can do that by providing them as much data as possible and help their decision-making processes and their strategies and stuff like that, I'm very happy to do it and yeah, hopefully learn a few things along the way.
Let's talk about day jobs a little bit here,
sure.
John, because I think it's relevant. So I'm going to talk about mine in a second as well, which is not that relevant, but I think it will help. But can you tell the listeners what you do for a living, please?
Yeah, so I am, for the majority of my job is I am a data analyst for Pro Football Focus, also known as PFF. So basically what we do is we collect a million different data points from football games and we analyze them and come up with our PFF grades and then a bunch of other different statistical points that NFL teams use, college teams use. We sell to the public as well that can be used for whether just learning NFL or for fantasy purposes as well. So I spend a lot of my time just kind of watching football and collecting data for PFF. And then I also write for the fantasy side of PFF as well, doing the IDP stuff.
Nice. I mean, it sounds like a dream job. So what's interesting is you're obviously an analytically minded person and you work with football. So you spend hours every day trying to gather data about football and going, what does that mean? What can we do with it? And I think that shows in your work. So you just put up linebacker tiers on the site this week. And rather than just a random list of people you think are good who you sat down and put in order, there is meticulous, rigorous detail in the process of how you've got to where you are. And I think that really comes through. There is a difference between analysis and opinion, and it shows up.
Yeah, I think it's important, right? Because, I mean, anybody could put a rankings list together, but coming up with the reasoning behind that ranking and actually having data to support your argument, I think is important. Because when people do challenge you on rankings, which they ultimately almost always will, you want to be able to support your claims. But also you want to keep the people that are reading those rankings as informed as possible and help them understand kind of what goes into it and why certain players are ranked where they are. So hopefully the linebacker tiers article I put out this week does that, and I'm going to do it again for the defensive line and for the defensive backs as well in the coming weeks. So try to just provide as much evidence-based data as possible.
Totally. And I said I was going to talk about my day job as well. So I'm a media planner, right? So my job is basically taking a load of insight and a load of information, and then for a given problem, brief, objective, whatever, we go with all that information that we understand, what is a solution that fits all those points and comes together? So this is interesting because we deal with similar bits of information. I think we're both very, very focused on our day jobs of take all this information and then whatever the answer it points to you, you need to work out your approach beyond that. And that's probably quite different. So when I was first really developing as an IDP analyst, I was lucky to work with a brilliant econometrician who my buddy called Good Mike. He's just had a new baby, so congratulations, Good Mike. But he's an econometrician, right? So I would go to him and go, look, I've got these data and bits and pieces, and I've got this hypothesis. Can you help me test it? And he'd go, yeah, this is how you do some crazy multi-nested index match in Excel that will prove that out, or stick it in whatever crazy econ tool he's got. So I think the evidence part of this and the results is really important. And that's what sets us apart in this gig, because you're always looking for data that points to an outcome. And if that outcome is surprising and not what you expected, it's still the answer. So a couple of examples of that. One, we talked about rankings. Our human brains, our lizard brains, are conditioned to expect what just happened to continue happening, right? So we look at last year's rankings and we go, well, that's their starting point. They're probably going to start. So I put out some numbers the other day and somebody came to me and said, why have you got X player playing 700 snaps? He played 900 last year. Why is he going to lose 150? And it's really easy to think that way. But of course, he's not losing snaps. You start from zero and you carry on until something happens. But that's just the way our brains think. So I think that outcome evidence rationale versus our natural instinct to expect the same thing to probably happen again is a good way of thinking about it.
Definitely, right? Like, it's all about the way I kind of see it, and the way I've always framed it is that we're not going to be able to predict the future. We can't do that, right? But it's about building as much data and data points in our favor that increase our odds of hitting on players, right? So that's kind of been always the focus of everything that I've tried to do is just to increase those odds. And we're all going to be wrong a lot, but if we can actually do the work in predicting where players are going to land, then, you know, we might be right more than the average fantasy ranker or whoever, right? So, but yeah, you're right. Looking back at just what a player did last year is not the best, most efficient way of doing it. And it's something that you see quite a bit for sure.
Yeah, when I first built a projection tool, actually, on that, Jeff, your old employer of the Rat Pack, years ago, I sent him an email when he was at PFF, and I said, I want to build a IDP projection tool. How should I do that? And he emailed back, and he went, don't do it unless you're getting paid. And I ignored his advice, and right. I did it anyway, which worked out, but it was good. And anyway, the point was, when I first built it, my sacks were built on parsec numbers. And it was really bad. It didn't work very well. And I missed out on high-end ones, and actually my accuracy was just low anyway. You know, standard deviation was out by, you know, 7, 8 sacks pretty commonly. And then I changed it to work on pressures and then calculated sacks as a sensible, pretty flat rate of pressure conversion and instantly got much better, right? So we're learning this stuff, but it's non-intuitive that you have to understand the process behind before you can do the projection. Otherwise, it's going to be wrong.
Yeah, no, exactly. My favorite example is like the Hassan Reddick truthers, right? That believe he's going to be double-digit sacks every year for the rest of his life now because he did it 2 seasons in a row. But it's just you dive deeper into the data and you're able to pull that, you know, these aren't things that are going to happen. And sacks are definitely not the stickiest stat to rely on year over year, that's for sure.
Let's talk about a couple of examples of this, and then we'll get on to what we actually said we were going to talk about. So first is TJ Watt. And so TJ Watt is relevant here, I think, because there's a few different things going on. So he played whatever it was, 750 snaps, something like that, off the top of my head last year. Not very much. Had 22 sacks. And the reason he had 22 sacks, you know this, is because his pressure to conversion sack rate was absolutely crazy. It's like 35%, right? And average for a edge is somewhere closer to 15%, 12% maybe. So, you know, that stands out. But he's going to regress in both of those things. He's likely to play more because he's probably not going to get as injured as he was last year, although I don't think he's going to stay fit for the whole season. That's stupid. But also his conversion ratio is going to come down. It's going to. It's never been that high before. He didn't suddenly... It's just going to. So we're in this situation where we have to balance those two things. So where are you for TJ Watt next year? I mean, he's basically getting drafted as the top edge in IDP,
yeah,
pretty clearly. Is that your starting point?
It's close. I mean, the reason I still have him high is first because of the tackle numbers. He's on the field a ton, so he boosts his floor a little bit with the tackle numbers. So he definitely is one of those players to be cautious about, I think, and putting him automatically as the first edge off the board or taking him way higher than some of the other guys like Myles Garrett and Nick Bosa, I think is a dangerous way to do it, just because, like you said, that I think it's 36% pressure to sack rate ratio. So more than 21 points higher than the average for edge rushers that play 100 snaps. So the only other thing that I think changes, like makes it okay, not okay for him, but safer for him, is that he grades well in other stable metrics, right? He still has a good pass rush grade, still has a good win rate and things like that. But betting on 22 and a half sacks again is I think it's a mistake, right? He's probably a good lock to get double digit sacks, but not to lead the NFL again.
Yeah, I've got him down for like 13, 14, something like that, which is a huge number. Right. That's really impressive. And until a couple of years ago, you know, you could basically count on about 10 edge players having double digit sacks a year. So even for our mean projections to have 13, 14, it's crazy high.
Yeah.
But, you know, people are going to look and go, well, that's a lot lower than 22. So that's stupid.
Right. Yeah. He had a bad year then.
Right. Micah Parsons. Micah Parsons had whatever crazy numbers last year. He was basically the most efficient pass rusher in the NFL and stood up against Hall of Fame players. Now, Micah Parsons is really good, just like TJ Watt's really good. But do I think he's going to be a better pass rusher statistically than Nick Bosa and Myles Garrett and whoever you want to say consistently through his career? Absolutely not. That's crazy.
Yeah, for sure. I've been lower on Parsons, and I get a lot of slack for it. Trouble for it, but you're right. That's exactly what it is, right? Knowing that these, you know, how high his efficiency was, and knowing that he's due for a regression. Even if it doesn't happen next year, if he ends up with 11 sacks next year, people are gonna, you know, spit in my face and tell me how stupid I am. But at the same time, over his career, those numbers are gonna come down. They're gonna regress, even if he continues to remain as a highly graded pass rusher and things like that. So the regression is real, and I think it's important to kind of factor that into a lot of the rankings and projections and stuff like that.
Let's talk about that on tackles. And we've talked about both these guys off camera today. I want to talk about Denzel Perryman and Minkah Fitzpatrick. So both of those had crazy high tackle efficiency rates, you know. So Denzel Perryman, off the top of my head, was 17%, something like that. He was recording it as a tackle or an assist on that number. For a linebacker, it's going up over time, but average is probably about 12% at the moment. So it's significantly over that. And then Minkah, who lines up deep a lot. Sure, he rotates down into the box. He moves around a little bit after the snap, but he lines up primarily as a deep safety, led all safeties and tackles, which is weird. But do you think either of those have any sort of hope at sticking and remaining strong?
No, I am concerned about both of them, especially Denzel Perryman, just for volume alone. I think is gonna decrease what his tackle opportunities are gonna be, especially with Josh McDaniels coming over from a New England system where Bill Belichick did not deploy a lot of full-time defensive players, and there might be a rotation there. So that's going to take him off the field. And then, the efficiency so high that it's unsustainable, right? We know that just over time, and seeing those numbers decrease for every player that has had that incredibly high tackle efficiency. Minkah Fitzpatrick, his one job is basically to stay deep in that deep center field. And if you think about it from an offense perspective, you're asking, you know, 8 to 10 yards on every single play so that he has an opportunity to get a tackle, and that's just not going to happen. So it's more of an outlier year than anything else for Minkah, I think.
Yeah, you're always going to get outliers, right? Because in IDP, we're looking at 1,000 players. So even if, you know, 0.1% of players have a crazy outlier year, then you're going to get double digits.
Of course.
So you're always going to have happen. But it's just about understanding which things are sticky and which ones are reliable and which ones aren't.
Right.
And unfortunately, the ones that are reliable tend to be more, he's not going to do this. So we talked about Micah Parsons and his lack of tackle efficiency. Jerome Baker is a good example, right? Jerome Baker lines up more and more on the edge and is going to be a low efficiency player because that's who he is. Now, every so often, those sort of edgy linebackers get a year where they have loads of sacks, like Parsons, Devin White the year before, and people are like, oh, yeah, so it's going to work. But, you know, it's not sticky.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And people were down on Devin White last year because he didn't put up those, you know, 9.5 sacks or whatever it was the year before, but he still had a solid tackling season. Like, it's just, you have to be able to reset expectations every single year, especially for sack numbers, I think is important.
This time of year, right, we're seeing startups and I'm sure you're involved in mock drafts and seeing what's going on and try and get a bit more ADP together. But every year, right, that linebacker that looked good compared to the last goes a round and a half, two rounds ahead of everybody else. This year it was Micah Parsons, year before it was Devin White, year before that was Darius Leonard. And you're sacrificing real significant drop in the quality you're getting to try and get a guy who's almost certainly going to fall back into the pack. And I just think it's a bad process.
I couldn't agree more. And then you see it too, like even with like corners, right? Interceptions and stuff like that. Marlon Humphrey, Trayvon Diggs, those are guys that are everybody's first cornerback drafted almost across all IDP leagues from what we saw the last 2 years. And then obviously they disappoint the following year. And I wouldn't expect Trayvon Diggs to be putting up whatever it was, seven. I can't even remember how many interceptions. Way too many. But
you got 11.
11 interceptions. That's right. Yeah. So I've
got him down for 4 next year. I think you're pretty similar, and everyone's going to look at that and go, "That's a crazy drop."
Yeah.
But it's not a drop. You're guessing how many he's going to get next year.
Yeah, for sure. So,
I had a good player I was going to talk about then, and he's completely fallen out of my mind. Oh well, can't be that interesting, can it?
It'll come back.
Oh yeah, I was Marlon Humphrey. You just mentioned. So literally 12 months ago, people were like, "Yeah, Marlon Humphrey. Even in DB only leagues, you should be drafting him really high." On the back of forced fumbles and fumble recovery. I mean, if ever there's a stat where it's so obvious, it is not player determined. And, you know, people really thought he turned into Peanut Tillman and he'd mastered this skill. And clearly it was nonsense and it wasn't the case. All right. Anyway, we're going to be positive about players. So
yeah.
I always get criticized for being horrible about players and being negative, which is mainly because I live in this horrible rainy country. Normally I'm talking to Sticky and he's like, yeah, down in Florida. You, of course, are in America's hat, where it's cold and you're hanging around at the Hockey Hall of Fame simply to stay alive. I shouldn't be too mean. All my nephews from Canada are coming over to visit this summer, which is going to be wicked.
Nice.
So we thought we'd do a little show where we're gonna be nice about players. So the brief I gave you was basically players you're going to bang the table for, which I hate as a concept, but I thought it might be quite fun, and I certainly feel uncomfortable about it.
Yeah.
How was it for you? You're probably a bit... Well, you're sitting there in front of Derwin James, so you've definitely got some my guys.
Oh, yeah. So I'm with you, like, and then I'm typically more skeptical of players on the whole at going into a year. But there's definitely, I think I definitely have more guys that I tend to reach for in drafts because I'm a believer in them, or I just want to have them on my roster. Derwin James being the biggest example, I'll happily reach for him just so that I can be happy looking at my roster, even if it's losing. But yeah, this was a fun process because I hadn't really looked at it yet this year, even like all the draft data that I had done so far. I wasn't really sure which guys I was looking, like I have a feeling, but wasn't sure. So I did come up with a list of guys that I'm pretty happy with and definitely interested in seeing yours because I know, you get a lot of, trouble for hating on players. So it'll be fun.
You never really know who your guys are until you've done some live drafts, right?
Yeah.
So going into rookie drafts this year, I had no idea I was way higher in Troy Andersen than most people. And then, you know, after I did like two or three drafts and go, people think he's 20 spots worse than I do. So you end up with a load. But
yeah, no, exactly. And a lot of my guys are, I think a lot of them are just more like value-based than anything. Mm-hmm. And guys that I think have good data behind them that might push them a little bit up more my board and push them, maybe not put them on the radar for other people. So
let's dive in then, shall we? And we'll do it in a weird order, because if you start at the front of the line of scrimmage and go back, it sort of doesn't really work. Why don't we start with the second sexiest position, and we'll start with edge. So who, name a player you've got who you would bang the table for. Who was that running back that Kyle Shanahan drafted a few years ago in the second round that you banged the table for?
Trey Sermon?
And never did anything. No, before that. His name was like Joe Daniels or something.
Anyway, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. I think I know what you're talking about.
I've literally forgotten him. Anyway, sorry, give us an edge.
Yeah, no, so I got a couple edge players, but I'll start with one that I'm a little bit higher on, and that's Marcus Davenport of the New Orleans Saints. So, yeah, last season, I think, even despite playing just 11 games, could really kind of be considered a breakout season for Davenport, which, you know, a lot of people are saying finally. People were starting to give up on him. He had definitely been a bit of a disappointment both in the NFL and for IDP for, I guess it was the past mm-hmm. 3 years of his career. But him, along with somebody like Rashawn Gary, I think are kind of like the poster child for these, you know, being patient with these talented edge rushers that do have high draft capital, because it does take them a little bit of time to acclimate to the NFL and kind of find their footing and then start to develop into top tier players. So it started, I think, last offseason. There were reports of him that, you know, he was putting it together and was starting to look good in camp and stuff like that. And they're like, okay, we'll see it when we believe it. And it did start to happen in the preseason. He posted back-to-back games of 90-plus pass rush grades. And even then, you're like, it's the preseason. We'll still see what we get out of Marcus Davenport when the season starts. So he got a sack in week one, but he also got injured in week one. But when he came back in week seven, posted another 90 plus pass rush grade and continued to be productive for the rest of the season, never posting less than two pressures in a game, and then finished with 9 sacks and an 82.0 pass rush grade, which was it was 12th among all edge defenders. So for me, Davenport, he has all these kind of stable metrics behind him to tell me that his production is likely here to stay. So pass rush grade, his win rate as well, 20.8% win rate, which is really, really good, fifth among edge defenders. And of his 42 pressures, just 16% of them were among the cleanup and pursuit variety, which was 24th percentile for his position, which is low, which is a good thing, which is what we want for our edge rushers. It's showing that they're earning their pressures more than they're, you know, like I said, cleaning them up, or they come as a result of a pursuit or something like that. So, I really like Davenport, even with Peyton Turner, a first round pick, another one waiting in the wings. Davenport, I think, should still see the field quite a bit, along with like a very aging Cam Jordan. But I think Davenport ranks, for me anyways, among a select few that I'd feel comfortable betting on double-digit sacks heading into this season.
Don't forget Carl Granderson.
Yes, of course, Carl Granderson.
Decent player.
He's not bad. He's not bad.
I'm really happy you talked about Davenport. I think he's really good as well. And I'm also really happy you brought up Rashawn Gary, because there's a lot of similarities between these two. Maybe not in terms of players, they've got different body types, they win in different ways, but both are very good at beating their man in front of them, even though it's taken them different amounts of time to actually log the sacks. So you can easily see a world where their sort of basic productiveness and level of play stays the same next year, and Marcus Davenport has got 12 sacks and Rashawn Gary has got 7 sacks, and sort of the narrative flips a little bit. Totally see that.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so the draft I'm in at the moment is just IDP only, best ball draft, one draft, so take it with a pinch of salt, but I'm using this for numbers today. Marcus Davenport was the number 15 edge off the board, a couple of spots behind Aiden Hutchinson and Robert Quinn. So Robert Quinn's a great example, right? Because we talk about him at pressure versus finishing efficiency, and Robert Quinn last year converted a stupid number. So my favourite Bears stat last year, off the top of my head, the Bears were, I think, second worst in the NFL at generating pressures, and they were fourth in sacks. So it was just weird. Yeah, this sort of stuff is going to happen to somebody, but you know, I trust in those guys. Yeah,
and those are the things
over those guys easily.
Oh yeah, Yeah, those are the things that people love to point out when they're against the pressure versus equal sacks argument, right? They love to find the outliers and say, well, this happened. But we know as a whole that it's just not the case, right? And yeah, Robert Quinn is a good
Yeah.
example. My God.
Travis Gibson as well. There's been a lot of chat about Travis Gibson this year, and he was a 40% conversion of his pressures to sacks. So it's not going to happen again. All right, love him. I'm going to talk about Guy. Whilst we're talking about Rashan Gary, actually, I'll talk about some related to him. I've gone Preston Smith.
Thanks.
So Preston Smith was really good last year, and people, I'm not sure people realised it. So everyone's talking about Rashan Gary. From if you get rid of the first 4 or 5 weeks of the season, where admittedly Smith wasn't that good. So, big disclaimer, it happened. I can't really throw them out. Preston Smith was higher than Gary in pressure for the rest of the year. He was like fourth in the NFL after their bye week in pressures, something like that. He's still a really good player. Now, okay, he's a bit more flexible, but he's not that pure out and out rusher. But Preston Smith at the moment, again in this draft I'm doing at the moment, got drafted in between Carl Lawson and George Karlaftis as the what? 45th edge off the board. 45th, which I will take all day long. So I think that's fantastic value. Edge is difficult, right? Because you've got somewhere between 5 and 8, depending on how you qualify it, proper elite top guys. And then you've got another tier of the next 40 guys who are relatively similar and might be better. But I think he's a great example of someone you can wait and wait and wait. By the way, Rashan Gary was going about 100 IDPs before him. So they've come off a season where they put up very similar productivity numbers, and one's getting drafted 100 spots the other before the others. Easy decision for me.
Yeah, it's a good call. He's one that I'm always surprised to see late in drafts at this point. And yeah, 40th round, like that's where I've seen him as well. I think it was like 45th round or something like that. I scooped him up because even in a dynasty, like that's, I mean, you're getting immediate production either way, right? So even with his 9 sacks last year, which is a good number, it was still compared to like his pressure rate was actually slightly below average pressure to sack conversion rate. So there's room for movement upwards for him as well if he continues that same pressure rate, which obviously is hard to do because it was a good pressure rate. It's like 14.8%, something like that. So but yeah, you're right. I think the reason he gets overlooked is because of that Rashan Gary breakout. This happens a lot with IDP when there's a young guy and an older guy. The young guy just boosts way up the draft boards and the old guy's often forgotten. So this is a good example of that.
Take advantage of that all day long. And then, yeah, interesting. I'm looking forward to watching the Packers defenses. Yeah, so talk about that. All right, give me another guy. You've got another edge on your list, haven't you?
Yeah, and it's another one of those kind of late breakout guys, I think. This is a really late one. It's Randy Gregory for the Broncos. He's 29 years old
Ooh.
now. Yeah, so never really posted more than, what, 6 sacks in a season. But he's also never played more than 457 snaps in a season. So he's missed time with injuries and suspensions, and he's only played for the Cowboys. So that kind of factors all into that. But now the Broncos have given him a pretty decent-sized 5-year contract, which tells me that they do expect him to be a significant contributor for their defense, which hopefully allows him to see more early down work and raise that tackle floor a bit. But he's never really been that type of player, so it could be just betting on the contract, meaning square peg round hole, forcing it for him to play a little bit earlier. But we'll see. But even just focusing on like passing situations for Randy Gregory, he's been really, really good. 80 plus pass rush grades in back-to-back seasons now. Had actually the lowest rate of cleanup and pursuit pressures, just 6% among all edge defenders last season, which is a really good thing. Like I said, it tells us that he's winning on his own merits, which is much stickier than betting on sack opportunities to present themselves to him. So there's decent evidence, at least, that he's capable of cementing himself as like a top 20 edge in the NFL, and an increase in sack numbers would be a big step towards that, which I think he can do this year. And another guy that I think gets often pushed down the board a lot in drafts because he doesn't have those high sack totals.
Well, let's talk about the guy who's going to be lining up opposite him quite a bit, Bradley Chubb. Because your point just now about young and sexy versus old is a really good one. Now, I'm really intrigued by Bradley Chubb. He's played 4 years, right? And he's had some injuries, but basically had 2 really good years, which looked a bit better than they were because of weird numbers, and 2 pretty bad years. And he's coming up for his fifth year, so that's going to be his last year unless he gets a new contract. There's ways this could go. If he comes up with another one of his really good years, you go, no problem, Bradley Chubb is one of the 20 best edge rushers in the league. If he has one of those bad ones, you go, yeah, he's not really panned out, and he's never really done it. And you get that mass migration of people that thought Bradley Chubb was a superstar because he was drafted third or whatever, to, oh, he's just another guy. And he's teetering on this knife edge of possibilities for his career at the moment. Where are you on him? Do you think Randy Gregory is potentially the best Broncos pass rusher?
That's the way I have them ranked right now. I think both for redraft and dynasty. So which maybe for dynasty is a surprise because Bradley Chubb is a fifth overall pick and, you know, he's younger and blah, blah, blah. But like you said, those last 2 years were not just not good. Like, they were legitimately bad. Like, he was really poor, as a pass rusher. So 2 years, and then also, you know, he's dealt with injuries and things like that. So maybe that plays a part into it, but I'm kind of out on Bradley Chubb. I think I'm not a believer. I think there are plenty of other edge rushers that have shown a bit more and that are a much better value that you could probably grab a lot later.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that position for Denver. So do you remember 12 months ago that the Niners brought in loads of edge players because they'd just come off a season where they loads of them got injured and they were really stuck, you know. Kerry Hyder had to play 900 snaps or whatever it was, and they were really ruined. So this went out and splashed on Arden Key and got a load of people in, Samson Ebukam. And this year it seemed like the Broncos did the same thing. So they traded away Von Miller last year, Bradley Chubb got injured, and they were rolling out Malik Reed and some real dross there. And they've gone out, they spent money on Randy Gregory, they drafted Nick Morito, who I know PFF are big fans of. It sounds like they're moving Baron Browning to the edge, and they might have gone a little bit overboard. So I'm curious to see who ends up getting on the field.
That's true. Yeah, it will be interesting. Yeah, especially with the Baron Browning thing, right? Like, I don't know how much to believe, but it seems like they're pretty set in stone at wanting to try him on the edge. So, that by itself has me avoiding him completely in drafts, Baron Browning.
Yeah, and well, linebacker is such a problem for that Broncos team as well. So it sounds like Josie Jewell has the confidence of the coaching staff. I mean, good luck with that. He's got the agility of a pregnant oil tanker. And then you got Jonas Griffith, who's nothing special. Alex Singleton, who is a big tackler, but nothing special. Justin Stranad, who has not looked like the player we thought he might be coming out of college. It looks like a real problem position to me.
It's a mess. And Alexander Johnson was their best linebacker last year, even on limited snaps, but even in previous years, and still haven't brought him back. So obviously they seem like they're happy with what they have. I mean, like you said, good luck. This is supposed to be a positive episode, but I just think about Alex Singleton and I get frustrated. So
All right, I'm going to talk about another edge. I'm going to talk about someone, again, slightly lower down, but I want to get your take on it. I want to talk about Arik Armstead of the 49ers. And yes, I'm calling him an edge here. So the way I see this, and I really want to hear what you think, is ever since Kyle Shanahan got there, they have treated Arik Armstead like a bona fide edge player. He's lining up on the edge of the defensive line, outside the tackle, and mostly doing all the things you would expect. Sure, he's 6'7", he's quite heavy, and you know, that's when you get people on Twitter going, his natural position is inside, all that nonsense. Doesn't matter, that's what he does. Sure, they move him inside, he plays in there, I don't know, probably 10, 15 snaps a game or something like that, but he's been an edge player. Now, last year that changed, because obviously Javon Kinlaw got injured in whatever it was, week 5, and they looked at their roster and went, wow, we really don't have another decent interior pass rusher, so we're just going to stick Armstead there. And he played more and more on the inside as the season went on. Assuming Kinlaw is back and healthy and hopefully plays a bit better than he has in his couple of years so far as a pro, I think the 49ers go, Armstead's primary job is again going to be a defensive end on the edge, because that's what they've always done before. Now, a lot of people disagree and think he moves back inside and either replaces Kinlaw or somehow they played the two of them together, which I think would be a disaster. So I think he's good value. He's gone in this draft I'm doing at the moment as the number 48 edge. So in between George Karlaftis, so basically Preston Smith, then George Karlaftis, then Arik Armstead, and just ahead of Tyus Bowser, who's a guy. Poor one out for the poor Ravens, who've had an awful week with a couple of players passing away. That's terrible news. But Arik Armstead at number 48, I mean, he's not that sort of... He's not ever going to be Yannick Ngakoue. He can go out and get you a bunch of sacks and nothing else. That's not who he is as a player. But he's reliable,
yeah,
and he's a good player, and he's a solid pro. So I'm going to bet in those things.
Yeah, and I think at 48 too, like just betting on the volume of snaps that he's going to play alone, wherever that ends up being, I think is a good bet. So yeah, I know this is definitely one of those contentious topics that every offseason with Armstead, right? Because people do think, you know, he'll play inside more. And I think it's hard, right? I think there's part of that necessity that still exists with the 49ers to use him more inside. I don't know if they will, but DJ Jones was a big one for them last year, and Kentavious Street played a ton of snaps for them on the interior, and they're both gone now.
And Kevin Givens.
Yeah, is Givens gone or is he still there?
I thought he was still there.
Okay.
Not sure. Yeah, but I mean, these are players that most people don't know, but are a good part of that defense.
Right, yeah. So with those two players gone, like those, I think probably were their best options. I mean, more like there's other disappointing options there, like Maurice Hurst, Hassan Ridgeway, like guys like that. Givens, if he is still there, you know, he's been fine. But there's players that you might not want to rely on for the volume of snaps. So there's, and again, we talk about this too, like defense is trying to be multiple and use players in different ways and show different fronts and have your best players on the field and blah, blah, blah. So there's that aspect to it as well. So I tend to believe that Armstead will still get a decent amount of inside usage, even if it's not like an every down, like full-time role as an interior defender. I think it's possible that
20-25%, that's sort of my benchmark. Okay. That's what I'm expecting. More than 30%, I'll be surprised.
Yeah, it's hard, right? Because there's, and they did, they, to be fair, like they did bring in a bunch of edge rushers again this season. So, and we drafted Drake Jackson in the second round. They brought in one of our favorites, Kamoko Touré. Charles Omedahu, is he an edge or not? I don't know. We'll see how they use him. Because I know they talked about using him inside at one point as well. But
Kerry Hyder as well.
Kerry Hyder,
you know, he's a tweener, right? He can do both. And Dee Ford, did he retire?
They haven't officially released him, but I think they've said that once he passes his physical, they're going to release him, so he's gone.
Yeah.
But
I think this is a good example of why looking at starting 11 is not a defense, right? Because you look at these guys, and if you're just putting them one spot, then you end up in problems. What we know is that on certain looks, in certain downs, in certain situations, yes, I agree with you, Armstead is going to move inside. So people like Drake Jackson, in particular, Dee Ford, depending on what happened to him, probably even Ebukam, are designated pass rushers. They're not going to play on base downs. They're only going to come in to go after the pass rusher. So sure, Drake Jackson is interesting. He's probably going to be a half-decent player. He looks good. But you know, he's closer to that in Ngakoue end of the scale, right? They are not the same thing. So you can't just put them in a depth chart and assume that's how it works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the snaps shake out for that defensive line. Because I do think the 49ers ultimately, like, they do a really good job at, like, developing these defensive linemen and stuff. And Drake Jackson, like you said, is a really interesting player and somebody that I've been taking shots on in drafts, rookie drafts, because he's basically free in, like, the late fifth round or off the waiver wire afterwards. So I like him quite a bit, but yeah, Armstead is he's still going to see his edge snaps. I do tend to think that he'll still also see some interior snaps as well, just because he has the ability to do so. He's a versatile kind of edge or defensive lineman.
Yeah, we talked about efficiency, right? So for edge rushers, the more time you spend lining up inside the tackles, the worse it is for your pressure rate and your sack rate, obviously, because that's how football works. So that's what stops him being one of those studs. But when was it? 2-3 years ago, he's happened to get a load of sacks and have that really good year. So yeah, this is the difference between reliability and upside. So in a starting pick year 11, I'm going to go for Arik Armstead. In a big roster best ball league, yeah, give me Drake Jackson or who's the Cowboys guy? Sam Williams. Yeah. A similar sort of guy. If I can have 8 or 10 of those guys and start the ones who happen to get a sack in every week, any of the Bills defensive ends who would fit into that pot, I'm happy with that. But it massively depends on what that league looks like.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, should we move on from Edge? So a couple of players I was going to talk about, but we'll do different. I was going to talk about Matt Judon. So very quickly on Matt June, I'll do this in 10 seconds. You can do another one. It's basically, everyone knows that after the bye week last year, Matt Judon was nowhere near as good as he was before the bye. So he's dropping down. People sort of think he got found out or something like that. Matt Judon's still a really good pass rusher. So I like that.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I like Matt Judon as well. Probably the most stable Patriots edge defender that you can bet on. I mean, I know people like Josh Uche, and I just don't expect him to play enough snaps to be super IDP relevant. So it's Judon was like a legit workhorse last year, played like 900 snaps or something like that. So yeah, like Judon quite a bit.
The best thing about him as well, we talked about charting players earlier, is those red sleeves he wears. Right. He's so easy to identify. Yeah. It's absolutely brilliant. Must be great for offenses. You can see exactly where he is. But it's so great when you're trying to work out who's who. You can go, yeah, I can see the red sleeves, exactly where he is. Job done.
Exactly.
All right, let's do a less sexy position now. Should we do a corner? Let's do a corner.
All right.
Which corner are you going to bang the drum for?
Yeah, so I didn't put a lot. I typically tend to like the slot corners, but I wanted to put one that I think is one that is a decent value and I think a decent bet for volume and production as well on the outside, and that's Marshon Lattimore, also another Saints player. I don't mean to do that, but for me, Lattimore comes off as a guy like that is going to be, they're going to be relying on him every single snap, so volume is locked into an every down role, but also forced incompletion percentage is one of the more stable stats for cornerback production year over year. And he was last year's leader in that forced incompletion rate, which was like 20.2%, something like that. So the Saints, I find, you know, they play a lot of man coverage, which I think increases his opportunities for those kinds of plays on the ball. And he was also among the top targeted corners last year. He had 94 targets, something like that. So typically getting targeted quite a bit just because he's on the field a lot. I think he was 79 and 77 the years before that. So I think he could be in line to get picked on a bit more just as he gets older, but he's still a decent corner. And I think that, you know, in leagues where pass breakups and interceptions are scored highly, which they should be, Marshon Lattimore is a decent bet for good IDP production. And he's just another guy where he's going in drafts where I'm not taking cornerback early at all. And guys like Kenny Moore, Trayvon Diggs, AJ Terrell, Marlon Humphrey, they still get all the love and they're taken super, super early. But he's usually one of the first guys I'm comfortable taking in those like CB required leagues.
I like that a lot. Here's my killer stat for Marshon Lattimore. He led all corners last year in combined pass breakups and interceptions. So if you ask your friend in the bar who did it, and they'll say probably Trevon Diggs. And if they don't, they'll say J.C. Jackson, both of whom had 20 combined. Marshon Lattimore had 21.
Yeah.
It's just that only three of them were picks and 18 PDs. And right. you know this. The PD is one of those stats that is stupidly underused in IDP because it's a really good indicator of good corners and it's a really good way to make your cornerbacks worth more. So typically in a league, you'll see PDs scored at 1 or 2 points. No, that's stupid. Ignore that. They should be 5 or 6. And that will change your league for cornerbacks.
I like that. Yeah, and just to kind of point out, like, one of the leaders in those stats too, like from previous years, Trayvon Diggs scored really well as a forced incompletion rate the year before, turned into a league-leading interception rate for him as well. So not to say that Marshon Lattimore is going to get 11 interceptions, but at least if you're looking at guys that can make plays on the ball, Marshon Lattimore ranks in that range.
Totally agree. I mean, I totally agree with all that, but I'm gonna say the opposite now. So I went for a corner that is different. I went for a corner who I expect to have high tackles. So agree with you. I love a slot corner. We understand that the base expected tackle efficiency for a slot defensive back versus an outside cornerback is wildly different. That is why every year one of the guys of Kenny Moore or
Mike Hilton.
Who's the Bills guy that had a
Teron before? Johnson.
Yeah, Mike Hilton is great. Teron Johnson, that's who I was thinking of. It's going to be one of those guys. And one of the people on the shortlist who I don't think is getting drafted until very, very late is Elijah Molden of the Titans. He's a really good player and he's really scrappy and he's really physical and he's a good tackler and he is absolutely has in the range of his outcomes to be that guy that ends up piling up 100 different tackles. So sure, I'm with you, don't invest in cornerbacks, but you know, people are literally trading decent picks for Kenny Moore because they think he's going to do that every year. even though we know that cornerback is wildly unpredictable, Elijah Molden is a good person to have on your roster.
Yeah, I like Molden quite a bit. I liked him last year. I really like him as a blitzer too. I wish they'd use him more in that role, so you can maybe increase those sack numbers. But we've seen like that slot role in Tennessee be great for IDP. Think about Logan Ryan a few years
Logan
back,
Ryan.
Where he was like a super DB for IDP purposes in that exact role. So yeah, I love Elijah Molden. I think that's a good call.
I don't like that Titans defense though. So I mean, it's not quite Matt Eberflus or the Texans, but I just find it really dull. Yeah. I do not enjoy watching it. The only interesting thing I like watching about it, actually, Kevin Byard is pretty great. I like watching where Harold Landry lines up, because the fact that he is, you know, a high volume, really good edge rusher, and they're happy to put him in the slot, and they're happy to play him an off ball linebacker as well. Quite fun.
It is, yeah.
All right, let's do another position. Do you want to do safety or interior line?
Up to you. Let's go interior, because I have that in front of me right at this moment.
All right, I've got a good one here. I'm going to jump in front of you.
Go.
Sorry, buddy. I'm going to do it. I want to talk about Matt Ioannidis, because I really love Matt Ioannidis. He's a really good player. Now, sure, he got injured, hurt in Washington, but it was only 2 or 3 years ago that he had a brilliant, brilliant season. Matt Ioannidis is probably one of the 15... maybe 20 best interior pass rushers in the NFL, which seems crazy because no one's talking about him. So again, in this current draft I'm doing, he was the 256th IDP taken. 250. And Derek Brown, the big fat lump of not very goodness next to him, was the 98th one taken over. Derek Brown, I'm going to say it, he's been a bust so far. Now, okay, he's fine. He's a decent NFL player. He's not absolutely terrible, and they brought him in because the year before that, the Panthers were hilariously, historically bad against the run. So, okay, bust is probably pushing it a little bit. But Derek Brown is never going to be the IDP guy that you want. Matt Ioannidis might not be, but he's clearly the best pass rusher on the interior of that line. He's probably going to get room because they haven't really got any other viable alternatives, unless you believe in Bravion Roy or one of those guys. So where he was taken in this draft was in between Michael Pierce and DeMarcus Walker amongst interior linemen, both of whom are frankly just guys that I don't expect to do anything else. So if you're looking for that late potential guy who could really turn on, give me all the Ioannidis.
No, I agree. I mean, he's always been solid, right? Like, always 70-plus pass rush grades, good pressure rates every year, 12-13%, somewhere in there. I know it was a down year last year, but, yeah, going to Carolina, I think the opportunity is going to be there for him to bounce back. And, yeah, I'm it's a sore spot for me, like, recently, because I wrongly set my pre-draft queue on MFL in like the 45th round, 48th round, something like that, and I accidentally had it take Raekwon Davis over Matt Ioannidis, and I was really upset about it, so I was like, I tried to correct it for the next round, and then Johnny the Greek got Matt Ioannidis late for
they
us.
Are quite different players.
They are very different.
This is a good example of they're both called defensive tackle, right? Yeah. But they do not play the same sort of football.
No.
All right, who are you going to talk about as a big man?
Yeah, so one guy that I am, he's another one of those guys that I think I'm willing to reach maybe a little bit more for, and that's Christian Barmore for the Patriots. So I really like Barmore's rookie season. He earned a 75.4 pass rush grade, posted 48 total pressures as a rookie, which was a very impressive 12.6% pressure rate, and that ranks second most for total pressures from a rookie defensive interior player since 2006, behind only Leonard Williams, and Barmore actually had a better pressure rate than Williams. So that was even ahead of Aaron Donald in his rookie season, which was, I think, impressive. And not to say, again, that he's going to be Aaron Donald or that he'll consistently put up those kinds of pressure rates from the interior, but with great IDP pass rushing defensive tackle options so hard to find, I think targeting a guy like Barmore right now, especially in Dynasty, allows you to get in on a potential kind of big-time riser in terms of ADP in IDP for those DT-required leagues. And I think because he only had the 1.5 sacks last year, box score watchers are probably overlooking him, and they are overlooking him and don't believe in those pressures continuing. So I'm very happy to take Barmore, especially if he's going to be, you know, playing around those 600-plus snaps for Belichick and being a very good pass rusher, which we saw him do in college at Alabama as well.
Great shout. I really like him. So the way I look at that, we know the interior line is pretty stable, right? Because there's a steep drop off from the top guys. So you've got Aaron Donald, obviously, who's not getting younger. Jeffrey Simmons, it's really good. Cam Hayward is on that list. DeForest Buckner, Leonard Williams, depending on how you classify him, blah, blah, blah. And honestly, after that, there's a bit of a gap and a bit of a drop off. Now you've got Kenny Clark and Jonathan Allen and players like that, but I wouldn't necessarily call them great pass rushing interior linemen. Christian Barman has absolutely the chance to join that elite lift. If we're sitting here in 12 months' time and you go him and Jeffrey Simmons, similar sort of interior rushers, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. Grady Jarrett, we should talk about, but I think he took a big step backwards last year. So I was surprised when he got that big contract. This is quite weird for a Belichick defense, right? Because the way I look at their defensive tackles, certainly when they play odd fronts, which is most of the time, is very similar to Alabama. They don't really have a three tech and a nose tackle. They have two identical huge chunks, and they play left and right rather than nose and three tech. So it's quite unusual to see a tackle on that team who you think he's a bona fide, brilliant interior pass rusher, because we're used to more the sort of guys who are pretty good in tackle heavy leagues. Lawrence Guy, classic example. Lawrence Guy is a good NFL pro. He's not an elite defensive tackle. So I agree with you on Barmore. He might be. I mean, Belichick's basically the only defensive coach in the NFL that will change his system around the players he's got. So maybe it's an example of that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm hopeful. I think, you know, again, just kind of looking at the scarcity of the position of which guys are really good. I mean, I think Chris Jones lands in that category as well. And I kind of think of them as kind of those similar type of players.
Sorry. Yeah, I can't believe I forgot Chris Jones. Yeah, you're totally right. We were talking earlier about positional eligibility as well. So interesting alignment, Dietrich Wise, interior, edge, what do you call him? He's so difficult for me.
Yeah, Belichick likes to play around with those kinds of things.
Yeah, and all of that that school as well. So you look at the Dolphins, you got Emmanuel Ogbah, you know, basically 3-4 defensive end when they play odd fronts and edging in a four-man front. And then you look at Seattle and go, oh, it's just a mess. Ugh, confusing. Right, any other interior players you want to talk about?
Okay, so just one, that I think I get really late as well. Ed Oliver. So I'm cautiously optimistic, I think, is the way I'm framing this one, because these back half of the year finishes have kind of fooled me before. But keeping in mind where Oliver is going in drafts right now, so he's somewhere around like DT 20 to 24, sometimes later, but almost never earlier. I do like the chances of him outperforming expectations over guys with maybe lower pass rush upside. I think, you know, he had, again, a slower start to the year, which he's been doing his entire career, weeks 1 to 9, like a 66.9 pass rush grade, just a 7% pressure rate. But then from week 10 into the divisional playoffs, he posted a 76.7 pass rush grade, which was 10th among defensive interior players, and a pressure rate of 14.4%, which was 8th among defensive interior players. So turned it on late, and just kind of knowing that he was drafted as this undersized pass rusher from the interior, it was kind of seen as more of like a long-term project by most. I could see these as maybe signs that he's finally kind of turning it on and could potentially be that IDP asset that we had almost given up on at this point, I think.
All right. Do you think he gets to play enough to make it count? Because the Bills, right? They're addicted to rotating linemen. He's probably never, I mean, very rarely, he's going to play more than 25 snaps a game.
Yeah. I guess I have him more in like the 35 and 40 snaps a game.
And I've got to look it up. Damn you. Let's see what you did last year.
Yeah, that's a good question, actually. I know they like to rotate the edge rushers quite a bit. The interior guys, I don't know.
Yeah, you're right. Is about 35.
Okay, so
hands up.
No, it's good. Because it's true with the Bills, right? That defensive line and how they rotate. So I think he could still work in enough volume to get to those numbers and hopefully be a starting defensive tackle for IDP purposes.
I see your logic. Yeah. I'm I'm unwilling to do it based on where he's going, because he's still got that name value. So he played slightly over 600 snaps last season, right? Highest volume on the Bills interior line by 150 snaps, and he was still 40th among all interior linemen. So you sort of hope he's going to get another 200 snaps, and that's a big swing. That's a real serious change in how the team works. But I see your logic. I like it. All right, let's ignore linemen. I was going to talk about Dexter Lawrence, but I can't be bothered. Let's talk about safety. The best position in the NFL. I'm going to talk about Brandon Jones. I'm going to keep it to one player. I'll go Brandon Jones. So the Dolphins safety that's getting all the hype and did last year was Javon Holland, who had an excellent rookie season, played really well, put up some big plays, had a couple of sacks. Do you remember that game when they played the Ravens and their safeties like blitzed 35 times?
It's like all they did.
It was just a weird game plan. Yeah, and everyone looks at a total pass rush number for a defensive... I say everyone looks at pass rush numbers for defensive backs. No, they don't. It's only you and me. But, you know, I do. And they were somewhere near the top of the league. But Javon Holland is a deep safety, right? He's that guy, and he's never going to do that much else. And we talk about this all the time. Safety is hard to predict. Minka Fitzpatrick had a high tackle season last year. So it's not that deep safeties can't have high tackle numbers. They can, and it happens all the time. It's there is more chance of guys having high tackle numbers when you play closer to the ball. So if you've got two safeties like that, Brandon Jones quite often in the slot, quite often playing in the box, Javon Holland not very much at all apart from certain game plans, I'm going to take Brandon Jones. And they're basically getting drafted in the same place. So easy one for me.
Yeah, I love Brandon Jones. He's another one of my favorites for safety. I mean, the Dolphins, they did at least retain their defensive coordinator. I know, what's his name? The head coach. Oh, somebody's probably...
Brian Flores.
Thank you, Brian Flores. Is gone, but the defensive coordinator remains the same. So I think that similar usage for Jones, you know, playing in the box is going to remain. And the same with Javon Holland playing deep, right? So... I think it was like the third highest percentage of snaps played in the box in the defensive line last season was for Brandon Jones, and that created a top 20 tackle efficiency for him among safeties. So I'm a big fan of Brandon Jones, and I think you're right, and he should be taken ahead of Javon Hall.
The thing that gives me pause, I want to see about this Dolphins team, is what they do with the overall defense. So Josh Boyer is the defensive coordinator, right? But we know that Brian Flores was leading the defense and telling him what to do. So with the change in head coach, I'm really intrigued of what happened. Because what we saw with Kyle Shanahan and Robert Saleh, you know, Robert Saleh came from that Seattle tree, and he was pretty wedded to the box safety, free safety split. And then over time... Kyle Shanahan and Sean McVay obviously understand what their offense does really, really well, and both of those have deliberately pivoted their defenses to be based on two high shells with an extra defensive back played in quite a lot, because they know their offense really struggles with that sort of thing, and that's the way the trend is going. So part of me looks at the Dolphins and going, with your new head coach, are you going to get that defensive coordinator who was bringing Flores' defense to life to adjust more into that sort of direction? I don't know, but it's what I'm going to be looking at in preseason.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think Miami's an interesting defense to watch this year because they were so, I don't want to say unique, but well, they kind of were unique in how they deployed their defense last year, right? It was very man-heavy, very blitz-heavy. So it'll be interesting to see how much of that stays and how much of that changes with the new head coach, for sure.
Well, here's an offshoot question. Over the last couple of years, the most unique defenses in the NFL. So I think we're going to agree on this. The Dolphins, really interesting, really different. I would say the Chiefs, just because their personnel use and how they line up, do really strange things with the extra safety and play a lot of cover two. The Rams and the Packers, who have very much that extra defensive back. The Patriots, obviously, because Patriots. Anybody else? Those are the weirdest ones.
Yeah.
Oh, the Panthers.
Okay, yep. Carolina, yeah, did use a lot of time.
I love Phil Snow. Really interesting coordinator.
Yeah, no, but yeah, you're right. Those are the defenses that I think are most interesting. And ironically, they're the ones that obviously have the least IDP value a lot of the times, too, because they're taking players off when they need to be off and not just leaving them on the field. So Kansas City is highlighted that.
I always talk about this. I read a book a couple of months ago that was about the 70s and 80s Raiders and Steelers rivalry, and they were told a brilliant story of Ted Hendricks, kick him in the head Ted, and another linebacker, can't remember who it was, Oh, who's the guy with the crazy Brooklyn accent? Phil, whatever his name is, can't remember. Anyway, and basically Madden told them he was going to take them off the field on third downs because he wanted to, you know, to change personnel. And they skipped off the field holding hands, saying, "Because you're treating us like little girls." Now, okay, this was the 70s. It's not how we'd act now. But from where we've gone from that to even now, probably 29, 30 teams in the NFL are like, no, of course you have to leave your linebacker on the field the whole time, even when he's supposed to be marking or guarding some tight end who he has no hope of covering. I mean, it's crazy. And then you've got the Chiefs and the Patriots leading the charge go, you know, we're probably not going to do that, actually. But, you know, we're not going to put our players in really bad situations where they're likely to get burnt all the time. This doesn't seem that tricky a concept, but clearly defensive coordinators disagree with me.
Yeah, it is weird, right? Like, we hated for IDP, but it makes sense from an NFL perspective, right? Like, totally. Defensive coordinators are so afraid of getting beat by the run, right, that they want the linebackers on the field, but
yeah,
the pass is what kills you, right? So it is strange. Like, even this offseason talking about, you know, teams that were dime heavy last year that, you know, all of a sudden they're going to start leaning more into two linebacker sets again. It's like, but why would you? If it was successful last year and it worked, why move away from something that is typically working better, right, against the pass than the average NFL defense? And
offenses will figure it out straight away, right? So 10 snaps into the game, the offensive coordinator is going to go, "You're putting a lot of linebackers out here when I'm running four wideouts and they can't really handle that. So let's do that a lot more." And what's the defense going to do? You know, are we going to stick to it and ask, you know, Quay Walker to cover whoever your slot receiver is?
Cut,
good,
yeah,
luck. You'll get burnt. You are getting burnt.
Yeah.
All right. Who are we talking about? Safety. Did you have a safety? Talk about safety.
I do, yeah. I think this is probably the one that, like, started this whole conversation, right, of guys that we're banging the table for. And that,
yes,
is, yeah, so that is Kyle Hamilton. So I talked about Kyle Hamilton on my, like, rookie preview episode, and somebody that I've just kind of fallen in love with, and I think, I say think because I don't know for sure, obviously, but I think he can be a really good, like, top-tier IDP safety. So I'll start with kind of what makes me think that, and this is probably where we differ the most, I guess, right? So it starts with the belief that, you know, having a special player like Kyle Hamilton at that position allows you to do more with him, right? So I understand special player is a very vague term and completely subjective and can mean many different things to different people. So for me, how I see him is a safety who can and kind of will do everything on the field, and that includes from, like, playing linebacker at times to rushing the passer, and of course playing deep safety. But he does have the size and the skill set to kind of do that all, and also linebacker size, 6'4", 220 pounds, but moves like a safety. He's the kind of player that you do expect to kind of come down and support run defense, especially considering that their expected starter at linebacker is Patrick Queen, who by this point everyone is aware isn't good. So they bring in a guy like Hamilton now who I think can be a versatile replacement for Queen at the position in certain situations, which is also something that I think Harbaugh might have hinted to us last season when it was third down. Queen came off the field quite a bit, didn't even lead his team's linebackers in third down snaps. He finished second behind Chris Board, of all players. So they clearly do not trust Patrick Queen in crucial situations, and they will need someone better than Queen and Chris Board to be that guy. So the other part of this, I think, is what type of coverages are run on those obvious passing downs, because a common trend within the league is more two high looks to defend the pass. But for some reason, even still, the past two seasons, the most common coverage types run on third down are those single high coverages, right? Cover three, cover one, and it's by a pretty good distance. So it means that there's one safety staying deep and the other one coming down closer to the line of scrimmage, either to play in the slot, the box, or line up against tight end, slot receiver, whatever. Marcus Williams stands out to me as the guy who's pretty obviously going to be playing deep, right? While Hamilton should be the one to rotate down. So we might see him start in a too high position and then kind of rotate with those open closed looks, which is another thing that's being used more commonly in the NFL, is disguised coverages. Defenses rotating their safeties pre-snap to post-snap. So Yeah, I think, and I think he could be used as a pass rusher as well. I think just that defensive weapon kind of thing. I know it's another stupid term that we like to use, but if any player, especially coming out this year, stands out as that type of player to me, it's Kyle Hamilton. I was skeptical originally of the Derwin James comp, but I can see him kind of being used in a similar role. And I do think Derwin James is going to play a lot of that linebacker type role as well this year, but that's something else entirely. 100%. But yeah, I mean, all of this to kind of say, I am a big fan of Hamilton, and I think he does belong in that conversation among the top safeties, especially for dynasty purposes, right? That's kind of where it started for me, was getting a guy like Hamilton long-term, and why I was willing to kind of spend like a second round pick on him in rookie drafts, which is very high for a safety and I typically wouldn't do year over year, but I definitely reach for him, and he's the one guy that I think I'll go out on a limb and expect that top tier production from as a rookie, basically.
All right. I mean, I've struggled to disagree with any of that. I'm really excited about him as well. I think the way you talk about that team using him is bang on. Marcus Williams clearly is a very different sort of player. So we'll see what they do with the system and changing coordinator. I don't expect it to change too much. They have run a lot of too high. I get your point. Too high, he's the guy that's going to rotate down. Sure, but that there's another 10, 12 guys who are going to do similar things. Where I am and why I'm not happy investing him is just that cost of paying early to mid-second round. So my starting point for safety is don't invest any of them because of repeat rates, right? So new data that I ran this week. So repeat rate, i.e. year on year, safeties for top five is 10%. So 90% of top five are going to change. So if you look at the top five safeties in your league last year, all of those have a 90% chance of not being top five. For top 12, it's 30%. So look at the top 12 guys in your league. And then eight of those are going to be gone next year and not be that high. For top 24, it's only 42%. So even top 24, most dynasty leagues are starting two safeties each and then 12 teamer. Well over half of those guys are not going to be that good next year. And that's true each and every year. So my problem with safety is not about whether he's good. It's just general turn and burn and distribution and reliability is so low, I don't think it's worth that. Now, if I could get him later and if he's going at a decent spot and if it's a choice between him and, you know, some other players I don't believe in at all, of course, I get the value. I like him as a player. It's just the cost of acquiring him is more than I'm willing to pay for pretty much any safety.
Yeah, it's super high right now, that's for sure. Even in dynasty startups where rookies are mixed in with the veterans, I'm just thinking of, as you're saying, that the percentages of repeat rates, I'm thinking of that stupid Dumb and Dumber gif. So you're saying there's a chance.
Yeah.
But no.
So, yeah, startup, this draft I'm in at the moment, Carl Hamilton is the 11th safety taken overall. So one spot after Jalen Thompson. Good luck with him repeating, guys. I think he is a ginormous red flag. Two spots after Jordan Poyer. Give me Jordan Poyer all day long. Three spots after Jamal Adams. And he's gone one ahead of Minka, two ahead of Justin Simmons. Okay. Jonathan Abram. Carl Duggar. Carl Duggar is really difficult. Kevin Bayard. Kyrie Willis was taken. This was a while ago before he retired. Jaron Curse is going at safety 18. So what you need to pay to get Kyle Hamilton versus what people are not paying to get Jaron Curse, who is clearly a dedicated box safety. Yeah, give me that all day long. But mostly, I'm looking further down. So Brandon Jones, we talked about, safety 25. Adrian Amos, safety 29. Taylor Rapp, safety 30. It's just, you know, all of those guys, Justin Hamilton might be 5% more likely to have a top season than them, but
yeah,
they're going rounds and rounds later, so.
Yeah, no, I get that for sure. I think that for dynasty purposes, like some of those guys like Jaron Curse, I think it's more like kind of the 1 year value versus, you know, five, 6 years, whatever it happens to be, maybe more with Kyle Hamilton. So I think that pushes him up a little bit. For redraft, I'm more than likely to, you know, drop him a little bit than I would in dynasty, because I do want that type of player for dynasty purposes. I want to try to take a shot on some of those maybe low percentage chance of repeating guys, but I I mean, I'm a big Derwin James fan, so that's where I get sucked in, is thinking that he could potentially be in that similar role, and I could 100% be wrong, and then you get to laugh at me. So, and that's okay. I'm just taking a swing there, and I'm just thinking about all the usage and the stuff like that. It gets me excited and gets the blood pumping. So, I'm excited for Hamilton still.
All right. Well, I'm excited for your excitement. Right. We got one more position, sure. And we'll whistle through that, because otherwise people are going to have to listen to us all night. It's linebacker. We've saved the best till last. Let's try and keep these pretty short. Who's your number one linebacker you're going to bang the table for?
So I'm going to go with Cole Holcomb. Not just the mullet. But yeah.
you love his hair.
Oh, I do love that hair, though. But yeah, every down linebacker for me, in a top 12 zone-heavy defense, I think that's, you know, going double-digit rounds well after the likes of Micah Parsons, Devin White, Roquan Smith, Darius Leonard, etc. And those guys are going in like single-digit rounds. I think he's a lot closer to them in terms of 2022 IDP production than what maybe his ADP would suggest. I don't think Washington is overly confident that Jamin Davis can and will play an every-down role. They gave Cole Holcomb over 1,000 snaps last season, and while he's not an amazing linebacker by any means, we don't need him to be for IDP. He just has to be on the field, reliable, very good tackle efficiency, and he is. He's decent. He's right around that rate. We don't, you know, necessarily expect regression or anything from him because he's not overly high. But I think, you know, because of the Jamin Davis first round pick hype, that maybe pushes him down the board a little bit. And we just talked about this, like the old versus the young guy, not that Cole Holcomb is old, mm-hmm. but I do see that happen quite a bit where he gets pushed down the boards. I have him as my LB, I think seven or no, LB nine for this season. So yeah, I'm very happy taking Cole Holcomb for where I can get him in drafts. And I feel the same way about guys like Devondre Campbell who get pushed down because of excitement about Quay Walker, for example. So, And he didn't disappoint last season either. So, yeah, I love Cole Holcomb. And obviously, you know, how sweet is that mullet? It's the best hair in football, bar none, as far as I'm concerned.
So I'm with you on that sort of value. I like Cole Holcomb where he's going. You know, if there's 30 full-time linebackers, right? You basically take the last ones there. And there's Kenneth Murray and Kaiser White and people like that who have got uncertain roles are being taken before Cole Holcomb and, you know, even Tremaine Edmonds and people that we do believe are going to be out there. So there is an inefficiency there somewhere between LB20 and LB40 that you can take advantage of.
Yeah.
I agree with you on Jamin Davis, by the way. So we know this from Ron Rivera, right? So he drafted Shaq Thompson in the first round and then value at the moment. Everyone sort of forgets about Shaq Thompson. He had a bad, what was it, 2020 as an IDP. He had no picks and no sacks for the year, and that really hurt him. But I think Shaq Thompson's a reliable, decent player, and he's going, what, linebacker 16, 20, somewhere around that. I've been seeing him going drafts. He's literally being taken after Jeremy Chinn. And Jeremy Chinn's selling point is he plays a lot in the box for the Panthers, so he's going to get tackles. He doesn't do that as much as Shaq Thompson. So why are you drafting Chinn before Shaq Thompson in a less predictable position? Anyway, so I'm happy with Shaq.
Yeah, it's funny, right? Because usually like IDPers love first-round draft capital for linebackers, but which Shaq Thompson has, but because he sat on the bench for so long and he didn't hit the ground running and have that, you know, big Darius Leonard-type rookie season, people have kind of faded him and they push him down the board. And yeah, he's a big value as far as I'm concerned. He gets overlooked way too often, I think.
Yeah, he's got a weird blind spot.
Yeah.
Hmm. All right. Who's next on your list?
So the other linebacker that I put was Nicholas Morrow. So just, again, talking about kind of value at the linebacker position. This one, maybe it qualifies as a bit of a deep sleeper more than like a true my guy. But he's someone I've been able to scoop up late in like a lot of drafts and is likely for a high volume role in a linebacker friendly defense. So Eberflus mm-hmm. comes in as the new head coach of the Bears, another team that's above average in zone coverage rates last year, and has been known for like positive linebacker tackle efficiency. But he also missed all of last season due to injury, so I think that helps him fly under the radar a bit. But when mm-hmm. he did play in 2020, he earned a 63.7 overall grade, nothing flashy. But it was like 28th among linebackers. And then it also had a really good coverage grade, 70.4, which was 16th among linebackers. So I think there's something there to say that, you know, he can start and then stay on the field as the LB2 next to Roquan Smith, probably a little bit less snaps. But I think Bobby Okereke just played over 1,000 snaps under Matt Eberflus last season. And despite landing like 132 tackles, it could have really been much better. I think he performed under expectations considering the volume of snaps that he played. So you put in somebody like Nicholas Morrow, who just has to do as expected of him, and he could have a really productive season. And he's a guy that I'm really happy to take shots on late over even like Patrick Queen, Devin Bush, Jamin Davis, Kenneth Murray, all those guys.
I think it's a really good process. I mean, Nicholas Morrow, going back to 2020, right? That was the year he took Corey Littleton's job after Corey Littleton signed for that big deal in Vegas. And everyone's definitely forgotten him a little bit. I mean, I'm making faces at Matt Eberflus because it's so boring. I hate that defense. You know when preseason happens and everyone trots out that line they've heard before, which is, oh, teams are showing vanilla schemes. They don't really know what it means. They just say it because everyone says that. That's Matt Eberflus's defense. It's like that all the time.
Yeah. It really is.
All right. I'm going to talk about a linebacker. I've got two more on my list that I'm going to touch on quickly. Firstly, I want to talk about Dre Greenlaw of the 49ers. So, injured last year, missed most of the season. Azeez Al-Shaair came in. Frankly, did not play well. Was not even very efficient because he's not a very mobile player at all. And everyone's like, oh, maybe Al-Shaair is the guy and Dre Greenlaw is not going to play. I mean, no. Look at those two. Watch how they play. Look at how Kyle Shanahan treats his team. Dre Greenlaw is almost certain to come in and play next to Fred Warner. So I'm a big fan of Dre Greenlaw. And he's a blind spot as well. He's getting forgotten. He's going well outside top 40 linebackers because of that confusion. So I'll snap that up all day long. He's going about the same place as Pete Werner, who I absolutely do not believe is going to be a full-time linebacker, and Alex Singleton, who might not even have a real job.
Yeah, people love the guys that they got for free last year, kind of continuing in that role and hoping that they can do it again and get more, squeeze more value out of them. But yeah, every time that Greenlaw was healthy last year, they started him over Al-Shaair, even late in the season after he came back from the injury. And he's the clear choice for me. I know, you know, San Francisco retained Al-Shaair with like a second round tender. But from what I understand, like with the contracts and stuff, they didn't really have any other option for that because it's basically you use a first round tender, a second round tender, or the actual round tender.
Original round.
Right, which he was undrafted. So they didn't really have a choice.
So he's on like $2.5 million or something, which, you know, is a lot of money for me, but it's chump change in the NFL.
Yeah.
So just talking about the 49ers, we've said a lot of nice things about the 49ers here, and I want to be mean about Robert Saleh. So for years, Kyle Shanahan's 49ers had a really good defense. Robert Saleh got a job. He took over one of the worst defenses in football and made them worse. Now, sure, injury, blah, 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 happenstance, but man, he's got a big year ahead of him as well.
Yeah, I do like what they've done this offseason to kind of grab like positions of value, and you know, Garrett Wilson and Ahmad Sauce Gardner, and hopefully Carl Lawson can come back and look the way he did before he was injured. But like, yeah, Jermaine Johnson, another pass rusher there, so they added some good pieces to that defense. But man, yeah, you're right, it was so bad last year that it would be hard to to repeat as bad of a season as that. So hopefully they can progress nicely.
Hopefully, right? You got any more linebackers you want to talk about?
I don't think I have any more linebackers. Who do you got? I know you got a few here.
The other guys, I'll do them in 10 seconds. I had Matt Milano on there because I love Matt Milano. He's a very handsome man.
Yes.
Good linebacker, and he's better than Tremaine Edmonds. He's a better player than Tremaine Edmonds, although he never gets that. He's been injured. He's been in and out. So I can definitely see a world where neither of those are a Bill next year. But I like Matt Milano, and hopefully he can be a bit more consistent. And then Troy Anderson, we talked about, rookie in Atlanta. So that situation is a mess this year. You've got Michael Walker, you've got Rashan Evans. What's going on with Deion Jones? Got no idea. You've got Troy Anderson. I think it's going to be one of those, like the Eagles 2 years ago, where we see it chop and change and there's different person, a different combo every week. But 12 months from now, I don't think we're going to be looking there going, oh yeah, Michael Walker and Rashan Evans are locked in long term. There's a pretty good chance you go, Troy Anderson's the guy.
Yeah.
We talked about linebacker. There's really 5 or 10 good linebackers and 30 full-time linebackers. And I absolutely think Anderson can get on their list, and he's never going to be cheaper than that.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think taking a shot on, I mean, whoever you believe on that Falcons defense for the linebacker spot. If it pays off, it's a big lottery hit because it's such a friendly defense for linebackers. Maybe it's Anderson, maybe it's, you know, whoever, but especially for rookie drafts, he does tend to fall a little bit. So he's somebody to grab late. And I do have concerns that he's super raw and like he might not exactly, you know, mm-hmm. translate to the NFL right away. But yeah, you're right. I think, you know,
totally.
Down the road, it's clear that they spent a second round pick on this guy. He's probably going to get enough opportunities to prove that he can be an NFL starter. So there's that. And yeah, it's just a really good defense to have a linebacker in for IDP. And hopefully Deion Jones comes back, because I do still like Deion Jones. I know he had a bad year last year, but...
Yep.
Maybe he could bounce back.
But he's not dead. No. I hope he can come back. This Falcons defense looks really weird. We talked about Greg Jarrett. I'm worried about his future. Yeah. Edge, they were the worst pass rush team in the NFL last year, second worst of the last decade, and their best pass rusher at the moment looks to be Lorenzo Carter. So,
good luck with that. Arnold Bekesi
is a rookie. I hope so too. But, you know, James Vaughters is on there. Yeah. D'Angelo Malone is a late pick. Blah, blah, blah. Linebacker we talked about. Cornerbacks look really good. Great news. Yeah. And then safety, you're hoping what, Richie Grant and Jalen Hawkins play well? And there's a lot of serious problems on this defense still.
Yeah, they're not going to be good this year, especially. I mean, they got Marcus Mariota at quarterback now too, right? They'll be picking high again next year. I think that's a certainty for the NFL draft.
Yeah, almost certainly. Yeah. Right, we should wrap things up. We've talked way too long and too dorky. John, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Thank you for indulging wild fantasies and flights of fancy. We've talked about a bunch of different things. We've gone pretty deep in some things. Hopefully we've touched on some players and just like we said at the start, pretty good rationale and logic and rigor on why we believe those things. And you've been amazing. So thank you so much. Can't believe it took us so long to get you on the show.
Oh, no, that's okay. I thank you for having me. It was, a lot of fun, and I'm glad we were able to knock out two podcasts today for anybody paying attention to the feeds coming up. I appreciate your time as well, and thank you for having me on.
Right, I'm going to go and explain to my wife I spent more time with you than her today. But have a great weekend. Thank you, everybody at home, for paying attention. We appreciate your patience, your interest, and all of your wonderfulness. We have been the Read and React. Cheerio.